Okay, as I mentioned, Sunday evening, Psalm 81 is what I'd like to take a look at this evening. Psalm 81, if you could join me there. I don't know about your own Bibles, but most of the Bibles that I've ever had have titles written in bold, which are not the inspired word, but they are things that the editors put in. The title I see in my book is that Psalm 81 is an appeal for Israel's repentance. I know the American Standard Version titles it God's Goodness and Israel's Waywardness. Does anybody else have a different version with a different title? Pretty much all the same. That gives us an idea. You know, God has always communicated with mankind about the way he wants us to live our lives. Not the other way around. I just want to mention this again to y'all. Sometimes I get focused. I don't want to do a lecture. I'd love to have a discussion. But sometimes I get focused on what I'm looking at and talking about, so I might miss your waving hand or something like that. So just speak up or whatever it takes to get my attention, please. So Psalm 81 is effectively the it's a demonstration of a plea from God, and it's a demonstration of the result, or a promise of the result, when the pleas of God are rejected. So let me read Psalm 81 in its entirety, and then we'll go back over. To the chief musician on an instrument of Gath, a psalm of Asaph. Sing aloud to God our strength. Make a joyful shout to the God of Jacob. Raise a song and strike the timbrel, the pleasant harp with the lute. Blow the trumpet at the time of the new moon, at the full moon on our solemn feast day. For this is a statute for Israel, a law of the God of Jacob. This he established in Joseph as a testimony when he went throughout the land of Egypt, where I heard a language I did not understand. Verse 6, I removed his shoulder from the burden. His hands were freed from the baskets. You called in trouble, and I delivered you. I answered you in the secret place of thunder. I tested you at the waters of Meribah, Selah. Hear, O my people, and I will admonish you. O Israel, if you will listen to me, there shall be no foreign god among you, nor shall you worship any foreign god. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Open your mouth wide, and I will fill it. But my people would not heed my voice, and Israel would have none of me. So I gave them over to their own stubborn heart to walk in their own counsels. Oh, that my people would listen to me, that Israel would walk in my ways. I would soon subdue their enemies and turn my hand against their adversaries. The haters of the Lord would pretend submission to him, but their fate would endure forever. He would have fed them also with the finest of wheat, and with honey from the rock I would have satisfied you. A little background on Psalm 81. The things that I read while studying for this pretty much say that they could not date. Nobody has really been able to date Psalm 81, like a lot of the Psalms. I've got a note written in my own Bible that says 976, that says around 976 B.C. I've got a feeling that note in my Bible comes from Gilbert, when Gilbert taught us a class on the Psalms a couple of years back. If that's the case, and it's not really important to know exactly what date it is, but if that is the case, then what we're looking at is Israel before the divided kingdom, when it was still a united kingdom. It's Israel in or around the time of David's reign. And it's titled to the chief musician, which was typically the musical director of the temple eventually, but the musical director of the people at that point in time. And on an instrument of Gath. Gath was Gath or Goth. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it, but that was a town in ancient Palestine. And anybody from there was a Gittite. So in the King James Version, it says an instrument upon Gittith, which is the same thing as Gittite. So it's likely referring to a Gittite harp, another stringed instrument. It's a psalm of Asaph. This could mean a number of things. It could have been written by Asaph, who was once a chief Levite musician under King David, or it could have been written by a guild of temple singers who were under Asaph and descended then from Asaph later. Or it could have been transcribed by someone in the guild or Asaph himself and actually written or spoken by David. We don't have any real background on that, but those are the possibilities, just gleaning from how it and some of the others are titled as a Psalm of Asaph. Verses 1 through 3 come across as kind of a call to worship. Sing, give a joyful shout to the God of Jacob. It's kind of reminds me of Ephesians 5:19, where we're told to sing and make melody in your hearts to the Lord. It talks about, in verse 2, it talks about song, striking the timbrel. The timbrel was either a hand drum or a tambourine, you know, one of the circular things with little jangles on the sides of it. The harp, of course, which is to most ears a very pleasant sound, very soft, soothing, pleasant stringed instrument. And then the lute or the psaltery, depending upon which translation you're reading, which is another stringed instrument. It has a series of strings at different lengths, and it's a little bit smaller. It comes in various sizes and shapes, but it's smaller than the harp, so it gives, to me, a little tinnier sound, but still a stringed instrument. And the trumpet, the word that is translated here in blowing the trumpet in verse 3, the actual word there in Hebrew is ram's horn. So it's not the brass instrument that you think of as a trumpet typically in this modern day and age. It's the ram's horn. You know, they would cut off the ram's horn. They'd have that hollow large end, and then they'd cut the tip off. And I don't know if they had to doctor it any, or if it's just the way they cut the tip off, at what angle and what size and all, but using their lips and their tongue, they could make different sounds, and that's what they typically used. So that's actually what's referring to here, not a musical instrument per se, but just the ram's horn. It makes reference in verse 3 about blowing that trumpet at the time of the new moon and at the full moon. So it's giving two different periods of the month. Remember, the Jewish month, the Hebrew calendar, is typically made up of 12 months until it needs to be made up of 13 months, because the day and the month and the year do not all, the day and the lunar month and the year do not all coincide with each other. A lunar month is about 29 and a half days. So it falls a little bit short of your typical calendar day as we see it today. But that's how they measured it. They measured it with the first sliver of the new moon. And that's the new moon that's being referred to here. When this moon goes through its cycle and you just see it starting to shine again one night. Some of the feast days were based upon the full moon. I believe it was Passover and the Tabernacle feasts were based upon the new moon. It also talks in that same paragraph, same verse of the three, about the full moon, which is the middle of the month. That's when you've got the full shining disk of the moon, and then it starts to shrink from the other direction until it's gone again, and then you start the new cycle. So that's the middle of the month, and that is that was when, for example, the feast of the, what do they call it, the feast of the trumpet, the feast of blowing. They called it the feast of blowing, and the word blowing from the Hebrew actually translates as making noise. It doesn't necessarily mean trumpet. We call it the feast of the trumpets, and you see it quite often and hear this feast of the trumpets, because that's what everybody's assuming, because the Jews used, the Hebrew people used the horn so much in their worship. Pam?
This one has a Jewish dictionary and the Greek and the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And for that word, it says it could be clapping hands together, it can be an instrument, an analog, or driving a nail, or tent pin.
Making noise. Yeah. So it's making noise. It's actually the feast of blowing or making noise.
Yeah.
Of course, it's called trumpet. But that's why here we're not really referring to a specific event, but he's referring, the writer is speaking about coming to worship in any of these feast, solemn feast days. And they call them, he calls it our solemn feast days. The God of Jacob. The next section, four, is it four and five of that? Four through seven. Four through seven reminds them, reminds the hearer, the Hebrew people, that this is God's law, God's commandments, not man's. And it was done for the nation of Israel. It's a law of the God of Jacob. Notice this is the second time that the God of Jacob has been mentioned. Verse 1, the shout to the God of Jacob, law of the God of Jacob. I feel there's a very specific reason why only Jacob is mentioned here. And I'll get into that later in my invitation. at any rate, talks about the nation of Israel, the God of Jacob, and how the law was established and brought down even beyond Jacob through his son, Joseph, and other descendants. Joseph, of course, established, he made the way for the Jewish people into Egypt so that they would grow. When he was there, we see in Exodus 1, verse 5, that when he was there, there were 70 people plus himself. 70 Hebrew people plus himself. And then in Hebrews 1, verse 7, the land was filled with them generations later. Notice that the pronoun, the use of the pronouns change here. It changes from he to I. And we see this a lot in the Psalms and in the prophets, don't we? Where the inspired writer is writing and then God is speaking. I. We go from the third person to the first person. This, as I was studying for this, I noticed, and I was kind of amused at how this confused some of the commentators. There are commentators who will say that the first, I think they say the first seven verses. Yeah, they say the first seven verses are a fragment of a psalm. And then the remaining verses through verse 16 are a fragment of a psalm, and that they got patched together here. And they're saying that because of this change in pronouns. That's what they're basing it on. But if you look at it and you compare it to other writings in the Bible, it makes perfect sense. Realize, first of all, that the verse breaks, as we know, the verse breaks and the chapter breaks are all man-made. And while they give us a good opportunity to reference and stay on the same page and the same line with each other, sometimes it adds some confusion. We also have, in my printing of the New King James Version, I have italicized words, which I believe you understand means that it's an added word, a word added by the editor or by the translator to supposedly, as it says in my in the preface of my Bible, to make it clearer. They don't always accomplish that. I think they mess it up completely sometimes, and I think they completely messed it up here in verse 5. If you take verse 5 and take the last sentence, where I heard a language I did not understand, take that off of verse 5 and connect it to verse 6, I think it makes more sense. Because then it would read, and also the word where on that last sentence, sentence fragment, the word where is an added word. Let me read it the way I'm talking about and see if it makes a little bit more sense. Starting in verse 5, this he established, the law of God of Jacob. This he established in Joseph as a testimony when he went throughout the land of Egypt. I heard a language I did not understand. I removed his shoulder from the burden. His hands were freed from the baskets. To me, that makes more sense. I don't know if it makes more sense to anybody else or not. But some people say that the inspired psalmist was not inspired at this point, that he was confused because he was visualizing the language or trying to hear through the inspiration the language that he did not understand. And again, there are several commentators who back that up. I don't buy that at all. First of all, God's not the author of confusion. And secondly, if you're inspired, you're inspired. If you're not, you're not. It doesn't switch on and switch off. It's a pretty shabby excuse to use when you're studying God's word.
Well, he's also going back to the time of Joseph, and the Hebrews did not understand Egyptian.
Right.
So although they were speaking Hebrew, they didn't think Joseph could understand them because he was speaking,
he could speak both languages. Yeah. Good point.
So that could actually tie, since he's brought up Joseph already, it could actually tie that in.
I hadn't thought of that aspect of it, but I think that's good. And also consider the fact that the Jewish people, the Hebrew people, were being oppressed. They were enslaved. They were being mistreated, and they were crying out. But this kind of treatment is not the kind of treatment that God condones. So he could say, I don't understand this, right? Mm-hmm. If your kids or some kid you're in charge of is misbehaving, you don't understand that behavior. You see and you know exactly what's going on, but you can say, I don't understand that behavior. And I believe that's also a possibility along the line of what God is saying here. And of course, then he goes on to explain in verses 6 and 7 how and why he answered them. He took the burden away from them. His hands were freed from the baskets. They were carrying baskets of brick and mortar and also clay to make bricks, and doing all that dirty work for the Egyptians. And he says, I answered you in the secret place of thunder. Secret place. I mentioned this Sunday during our morning Bible study. To me, the secret concept is a little mystical. And so I looked this word up, secret, and it actually means hiding place, which to me makes a little bit more sense, the hiding place of thunder. Turn, if you would, to Exodus 19, verse 16. Exodus 19, verse 16. On Mount Sinai. And somebody has that. Would you read it, please?
Then it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there was thunderings and lightnings and a thick cloud on the mountain, and the sound of the trumpet was very loud, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled.
So isn't that how God presents himself at Mount Sinai? And he also presented himself as a cloud during the day and fire by night when they were following through the wilderness. And it says also, I tested you at the waters of Meribah, if I'm saying that correctly. Exodus 16, verses 1 and 2. Would you look that up, please? If somebody has that, would you read it, please?
And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness.
Okay, so you can see this is when they were complaining that Moses and Aaron had led them out of Egypt. They could have stayed at Egypt and been fine and been fat, dumb, and happy and enslaved and all that stuff, and now you're starving us in the wilderness. And they're losing their faith in God, if they ever really had any. But Meribah the name Meribah, that's where they're talking about. That's where this happened, is the place that they called Meribah, which actually means strife or contention. And Meribah is in the wilderness of sin. They were sinning against God because they were picking on Moses and Aaron for doing what God had told them to. And notice the Selah, S-E-L-A-H, at the end of verse 7. There are some dictionaries who say that there's no real good, clear understanding of what this means, but for the most part it's understood that Selah means a pause or an interruption, and I think you know that pauses can be used to accentuate a point. Interruptions can be used to switch topics, and that's why the Selah is here at this point. So we go from to a little change of direction here, beginning at verse 8. I have if then up there. God's commandments come with an if then proposition, don't they? If you obey my commandments, you will be saved, effectively. You know, if you do this, I will do that for you. It's like a contract. If you open your ears, then I will surround you. I will restore you. I will teach you. That's what admonish means. The if part is up to us, and then God. Then is the will of God. Verses 9 and 10 refer to the first commandment, don't they? Shall have no false gods before you. I believe it's about 4 verses long each time it's described. Yeah, Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. He's making a point again here of telling the Hebrew people, the Jews, that he is the God. They are not to mess with any other God. They're not to recognize any other God. They're not to accommodate any other God in their lives. So true or false? True or false? Whatever holds a man's heart becomes his God. Whatever holds a man's heart becomes his God.
True,
everything. All right. Whoever a man places all his trust in becomes his God. And how about family and business and friends and cars and houses and fame and material riches and egos? We can all replace God with that, can't we? We can allow that to happen. I was talking to you about ego earlier. I heard Lynn sharing our good news about lifestyles, wellness, and spa, helping us out. I went down there Monday. Lynn had the idea, I think, Sunday. She mentioned it to me. We should try them. So I said, okay. And I went Monday. And on the way, I prayed. And I got there, and very briefly, they were so accommodating, it was like they were waiting for me. They were waiting for us to come to them. And so we have an appointment set up to baptize the 2 women that we know in the wheelchair, and that is such a blessing. It's a spa. I don't know if it's the actual swimming pool or a smaller therapeutic pool, but they have a hoist. And they said we close at 3 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. Be here before 3 o'clock, and I will have the person stay, and we'll take care of it. It's like, boom, 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 boom. It's all in order. And I said, well, if you're going to ask someone of your employees to stay, can we give them something? She said, no, not for baptism. So it was just such a blessing. And I sent a message out to Lynn and to Sam and Harold and Stephen and let them know, hey, we've got this set up. And on my way home, I'm going, wow, look what I did. I hit the brakes. Said no. And I shared that with Lynn, that I was making the mistake of taking that credit. I shared that with Lynn, and she shared with me the fact that after she got my message, her first thought, or one of her first thoughts was, wow, I had a great idea. And she hit the bricks too. That's how our ego can get in the way of worshiping God and giving God the glory. But it also gets in the way of the end of verse 10. Open your mouth wide and I will fill it. Open your mouth wide and I will fill it. James Burton Kaufman is a commentator who's fairly decent. He's one that I like to follow. He's since passed on, but his comments are available on the internet. And he describes an image here of Israel as a nest of small birds. I don't know, you probably all have seen a nest of small birds when the mom comes back, or dad comes back with the food, and those mouths just open wide, gaping holes. You know, is there a bird in there, or is that just a mouth? Holy cow. And the spiritual lesson here is that God's gifts, both spiritual and temporal, are proportioned to our eager longing for them. That's the way he puts it. We read in Mark 6, verses 5 and 6, how Christ could do no miracles in his own country. Nobody was listening. Nobody had their mouths open wide. He couldn't do miracles in his own country because of the people's unbelief. And he goes on to say, God cannot give lavishly unless we desire lavishly. And he also says that tiny birds who do not open their mouths are never fed. Tiny birds who are never fed die. And I think that's a great lesson a great analogy that he came up with. And verse 11, Israel died. But my people would not heed my voice, and Israel would have none of me. They rejected God. They would have none of him. They rejected the word, and to reject the word means to reject the Father. It is so important to understand. In verse 12, what did he do? So I gave them over to their own stubborn heart. Have you ever had to take a deep breath and tell a child or grandchild, go on, that's what you want to do? When you knew that they were just walking over the edge if they kept going the wrong way and too far. But you knew that they wouldn't hear anymore. And that's what God did. He let them go their own way to walk in their own counsels. And then the inspired writer writes God's lament. In verses 13 and 14, I believe it is, yeah. It says, oh, that my people would have listened to me, that Israel would walk in my ways. And he says what he would have done. He would have subdued their enemies. He would soon subdue their enemies. That's how God works. If they're at the wall fighting you and you suddenly turn to God, it's not going to happen with the flick of a switch. It could if he wanted to. But he needs to see your commitment. And so he was promising, or he was saying, that he would have soon subdued their enemies. And then he would have turned his hand against their adversaries. He would have pushed them away. He would have protected them. He would have surrounded them with his hand. And that is such a treasure with his blessing if we walk in his way. And he goes on to say in verse 15, the haters of the Lord would pretend submission to him. Do you know anybody who says, Lord, Lord, and just doesn't do anything and pretends that they know the Lord, even though they know his name? They don't have a clue, or they don't act like they have a clue. The haters of the Lord would pretend submission to him. He knew that would happen anyway. Some would have turned, some would have not. We see that all the time now. And their fate would endure forever. The righteous judgment. He would have fed them also. Fed them with the finest of wheat and honey from the rock. The finest of wheat, the fat. It's actually the fat of the wheat, or the fullest of the wheat, that this is translated here. And the honey from the rock, how is this possible? Honey doesn't come from rocks. I know, I'm a beekeeper. Honey doesn't even come from bees sometimes. It's very frustrating. But Honey doesn't come from a rock, does it? But then again, neither does water or oil. Now I'm talking about, you know, a rock in front of you. Obviously, it comes from shale and things like that. But I'm talking about if I picked up a rock and squeezed it, I wouldn't get honey, I wouldn't get oil, I wouldn't get any water or anything like that. But how's it possible? Would somebody look at Deuteronomy 32? Deuteronomy 32, verses 13 and 14. Read that, please.
He made him ride in the heights of the earth that he might eat produce of the fields. He made him draw honey from the rock and oil from the flinty rock, curds from the cattle and milk of the flock with fat of lambs and rams of the breed of Bashan, and goats with the choicest wheat, and you drank wine, the blood of the grapes.
So Moses is talking about the abundance of good things, the abundance of sweet things. Here, just as the psalm writer is talking about the abundance and relating it back to passages such as that, the rock. It all relates to the rock of our salvation. So, let me ask you a couple of questions. Is the same true today as it was whenever Psalm 81 was written, as far as God's love for us, what He'll do for us, and what happens when we ignore Him? I think so too. I think it's very relevant today. Nothing good has ever come from exchanging the truth of God's word for a lie. He'll allow His people, He'll allow people to consume themselves by the lust of their hearts. We see all that in Romans 1, verses 22 through 25, I believe it is. Those who pretend submission to Him only deceive themselves, and their fate is sealed, as we saw in verse 15. So I hope tomorrow, if you're planning to feast with friends or family, that you'll remember the little birds who are so anxious for that morsel of food and so anxious to open their mouths wide and be fed. And I hope you'll be fed by the Word of God. Does anybody have any questions or comments?